standing alone at the gateless gate, too drunk on love to hesitate. And to the winds I cast my fate and the remnants of my fear. I took a deep breath and I leapt and I awoke as if I'd never slept. Tears of gratitude I wept, I was welcome here.
Tune to CFRO 100.5 FM, and I'm Charles Boylan. We're going to just give our friend his CD back, and we're done. Thanks, Andrew. Now, we're in money-raising mode because every twice a year, we have to go to you, the listeners of Co-op Radio, and ask you to give us a phone call at 604-684-8494. And we have to ask you to make a contribution to Co-op Radio. There's basically join it. And there used to be a little book. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Okay, it's a little book here, and it tells me all the things that I have to tell you. Inspirational radio. It says, okay, here's a pitching thing. Inspirational radio. What inspires change? Sharing ideas is one way to inspire others. Co-op Radio is an important place to share arts, ideas, and information. Well, share. We're kind of agitators in this program. And informers, educators. We bring public affairs to bear. And so discussion is a good show to support. If you phone now, we have a guy on the phone, a friend of ours, regular listener of ours, Joseph. He's going to be there to take your call, 604-684-8494. Now, you can join for $60 a year, or you can pay $10 a month. I just signed up a listener who knew us from Wake Up with Co-op, Sebastian, I didn't ask him if I could use his name, but it doesn't matter. He lives in Ottawa now, and he's just donated $20 a month. So that's great. That's like $200. That's just terrific. Thanks, Sebastian. And you can do the same. You can phone 604-684-8494. So this is money-raising time here at Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. Now, just to remind you, this is discussion. And so today on discussion, we have a little bit unusual kind of schedule. We're probably going to do a couple of things by pre-recording, which is not our thing. We don't usually do that. But what we're gonna do is open with an interview I did with the assistant director of the new Vancouver Opera production, Tosca, by Puccini. Now, we don't usually talk about opera in our show, but opera is part of the culture of Europe, and that's indeed one of the questions I asked our assistant director, who I interviewed some time back. I'm going to just play the interview. The opening night of this new production is this Saturday, the 26th of October. And then when you listen to the interview, it'll tell you various times. And one thing I want to bring to your attention, it's mentioned in the interview, but I want to emphasize it now. If you're short of money, if you're financially pinched, if you're a youth or you're unemployed or just you're low income, but you really love opera, the Vancouver Opera Association, the Vancouver Opera people have various means of assisting people to attend the opera at a cheaper price. Now, I'm not saying it's not going to still be expensive, but there are things. They have a TransLink Pass project and various other things. you have to give VOA a call. So, you know, go on a search engine and find the Vancouver Opera Association and go there, give them a phone call, explain to them that you really want to see Tosca and you really love the opera, but you need some way to make it doable. So I'm just going to say that. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go onto the computer and we're going to play the interview I did last week. So let's see if it comes up. Hopefully it'll come up. Testing.
So I'm going to be speaking with Fanny Gilbert-Collet, who is the assistant director of the Puccini opera Tosca, which is coming up on, as I mentioned earlier, on Saturday, October the 26th. And so, Fanny, thanks for taking time to talk to us here at Discussion.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So this opera is, Tosca, is set in a very dramatic historical moment of nation building in Europe. It's a time of revolution, period of Napoleon. Italy is striving for its independence from the Austrian Empire and so on and so forth. So it's full of turbulence and drama set in that situation. How do you see its relevance for an audience in Vancouver in 2013?
It's a very tense atmosphere, and it also portrays any tense political atmosphere. I think nowadays we still have a tense political atmosphere here. There is kind of a dark cloud over our heads. We feel like culture is being less and less supported. So I think that could resonate through that, even though it's a real revolution that the French lived and the Italian lifted afterwards, lived kind of the backlash of it. And even though Scarpia and even Angelotti and even Cavaradossi lived, they were real characters in, of course, obviously Puccini changed the names, but they were real characters in this historical, very tense times. It still resonates through our politics that is a little bit oppressive sometimes. So it could still be relevant for us, of course.
Right. I hadn't made the connection, obviously, with what I call the Harper dictatorship. But, you know, it is an oppressive time. It is. I mean, even we had news just today that this young fellow that's being kept in prison that is so mean-spirited, they threw him back in maximum penitentiary, this young Cotter lad who was a child when all the incident broke out. So there are. You're right. It's a period of tension. It's a period of violence and upheaval in various parts of the world and so on. So okay. So it has that relevance. Puccini, of course, is one of the I think three great Italian opera writers and composers. Tell us about how Tosca fits in with his overall work, his life's work, if you will.
Tosca is very particular. First of all, Puccini was very aggressive when he wanted to write a libretto about a story. So, for example, the play by Sardou that inspired Tosca is the play that was very interesting to Verdi as well and to other composers. So he got his hands on the rights, the first to get the rights. So he got to adapt it, but Tosca is very particular in the sense that the whole focus is on this lady who has no background of any political rebellion. She is not a rebel. She's not a revolutionary. She is a singer, an opera singer, and she's got this very deep rage. And when she hits the wall with Scarpia's attacks and harassment, she commits the most revolutionary act ever. She just
takes
murders.
Up arms.
Yeah, she takes up arms, and she's even more courageous than the French, Cavaradossi, her lover, who is the revolutionary in the story. But she makes, like, she takes the action. She does it, and Cavaradossi doesn't do it. So that's the very interesting part of it. And historically, Tosca has been well known for being a play first by Sardou, and it was a huge success with Sarah Bernhardt all around Europe, for sure. So everyone knew about the play. Then when it got adapted in an opera, the audience was already sold to the opera. So the opera got a huge success as well, and it still is a huge success nowadays.
Right. And so it just from the sheer drama of it, Would you say something about Puccini in that he makes the woman the heroine, the actor, the mover of this historical event?
Totally. And also we discovered by reading a recent article about Puccini's love life and all his mistresses and all his lovers during his life that Tosca is one of his lovers of the time. So every opera, La Fanciulla del Vest, Bohème, every opera has a heroine inspired by one of Puccini's lover at the time. So that's also very interesting, because this very jealous woman, very possessive woman, is someone whom Puccini knew for real, who existed in reality also.
So he's really embodying this historical figure with the stuff of his time. Tell us a little bit about the musicality of the opera. Why, when people go, let's face it, Vancouver has its opera fans and it's limited, but to expand the base of opera attendance, you know, could you maybe sell it a little bit on the basis of the pure musicality of Puccini's?
Puccini is the best to introduce people to opera because he makes it so condensed and so real that you have no choice but to let yourself go and get into the story and get into the music. The music is so well written, meaning that everything is there for a reason. There's no long pause, there's no time of absence or time of repeating stuff. It's always going into a certain direction, and the dramatic tension is always there. So anyone can follow the story very easily and listen to one of the most beautiful music in my ears. In my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful music because it's always supported by dramatic action, always. So it's fantastic. So for someone who doesn't know opera, he can very easily just get into the story.
Go into the flow.
And just let himself being told a story for 2 hours. That's fantastic.
Right. All right, very, very good. So tell me a little bit, you mentioned before the interview that the director of this opera in Vancouver had a number of years of experience in Germany, and that influenced his approach to it. Can you mention who the director is and talk a little bit about the approach he's taken here?
Of course, Joseph McLean is the director of Tosca, and it's not the first time that he's been directing Tosca, so he really knows the story inside out, he knows the characters inside out. He is very emotionally linked to the story, and he's got this very interesting point of view on the story that makes Cavaradossi know about his fate in the third act, whereas Tosca doesn't know what's gonna happen in the end. And I don't want to be a spoiler alert, so I'm gonna stop there. But it's a new vision of the contrast between the two lovers at the end. One knows something that the other one doesn't know, and we get this dramatic tension inside the music and inside the whole staging that makes it very compelling. And I think that also comes from a European influence, or maybe it's his personal way of working, but it really feeds the whole cast on specific background. He also gave them excerpts of the play by Sardou, so he's got a lot of research, he knows a lot of information, he really feeds the singers with historical stuff and a lot of actions and drama to act, basically.
Right, so it's like a play and an opera in
exactly.
The sense that it's very dramatic. Tell us a little bit about the lead characters. Tosca's played by...
So she is sung by two wonderful singers. This time we have a double cast. So there's Michel Capalbo, who is singing the Tosca during opening night and other performances. And there's also Tamara Mancini, who is the other Tosca. And so they were both in rehearsal trying to learn the same staging and the same process at the same time. And that makes them connect and also exchange points of view. And that's very interesting and very... very rich to the process, and there are also two Cavaradossis, because it's such a big opera to sing, and we've got so many performances. These roles cannot be sung day after day. It's too big for the voice.
Too much work.
So that's why it's doubled. Cavaradossi is sung with Michel Capalbo. There is David Pomeroy, who's singing during opening night, and after that with Tamara, it's Adam Degen, and so we can see a very specific Cavaradossi and a very specific Tosca. Every couple is different. Each couple has his own its own energy, its own love affair, passion on stage, and it's very interesting to see it grow through the process.
Right. So that just remind us again the dates. It starts on October 26th.
Starts on October 26th, and then we have performances on November 1st. We start on October 26th. We have performances on October 31st, November 1st, November 2nd, and November 3rd, which is a matinee. And the evening performances are at 7:30 p.m., and the matinee performances are at 2 p.m.
And it's still produced at the Orpheum Theater, is it?
It's at Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, Queen Elizabeth Theater. Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. So, and then if people want to get tickets, they can just go where?
They can call the Vancouver Opera by phone, or they can go on vancouveropera.ca online, so they can buy it online, or phone, so call at 604-683-0222, and they can pay via MasterCard or Visa or any credit card.
Or just go on a search engine and put in Vancouver Opera Association.
And they'll find it very, very easily
on your smartphone, right?
Yeah, exactly. Tosca's everywhere right now in Vancouver.
Fair enough. Well, listen, just before we wrap up, Fanny, just tell us a little bit about your own. You're assistant director here. What is your task, basically, as assistant director in that?
It changes from production to production, but right now I am very, very privileged to be working next to the director, meaning that I get all of his input, all of his opinions. He asks me questions. He tries to get feedback from me, so that's very interesting because I learn a lot. And also, as the process goes, I get to take notes and give notes to the performers, so that's very interesting as well because it's a matter of communication and it's a matter of understanding very well the director's vision, because I'm kind of transporting or transferring his vision to the performance, to the actual cast who is doing it. So that's very interesting. And I also get to kind of supervise the whole production. So every time there's a decision that needs to be made, well, I give the message to the directors. So we really work together on that. And that's
a good steep learning curve for
you. Yeah. Oh yeah, and it's also very challenging. So it's great to be working in English. Also for me, that makes me practice a lot. Makes me see how it goes. Everyone, what's everyone's task and what's everyone supposed to do. And yeah.
Right. Yes, and you of course mentioned off air that you're from a French background. Grew up in Montreal.
Exactly.
And then went to the University of Ottawa for a master's in.
In theater directing.
Theater directing.
Yeah. And then went to Germany for a year to teach French and came back and.
Okay. So now this is a good beginning job, or how do you regard this? Landed a good one.
Yes,
yeah, because you did mention, and we know that the financing for the arts is very, very dismal.
Yeah.
And so it's very, very challenging for a young generation or even the older established artists in various fields to find monies to sustain them to do their artistic work. You want to make a comment about that?
And it's hard, but we still have to keep trying and keep creating our own jobs. So that's what's happening to me, because no one really wants to be a stage director for opera from their 20s. It's very rare. Most of the people do theater and then get a reputation and then get asked to direct operas, but no one really wants to start from that. So I'm kind of building myself here at Vancouver Opera. It's the first time that they have a stage director in the Young Artist Program. So they kind of opened, create the position for me. And it's really a work in progress. So I approach different specific opera houses, I approach different programs, and I tell them, I talk to them about the importance of being well directed, of having a stage director who can help the singers perform even better than they do already, and that kind of creates a whole range of possibilities for me. So it's just creating your own job. That's what we're at right now. So we cannot be discouraged for doing that, because it makes us work even harder.
Use your initiative, right on.
Yeah,
when you mentioned that teaching the singers to be actors, and of course there has always been that bit of a tension in opera production that the singers are great singers, but they're stiff as wood when it comes to presenting a character. So, I mean, to exaggerate, but that is a problem, isn't it? Because they are really trained as singers. Yeah. They're not trained as actors. And
well, it's the technique that is asked. It's tremendous. It's such hard work, and it's a lot of effort and concentration and focus only on the technique, so the rest kind of tends to get aside.
Right.
But the new generation is very well aware of that, and they get to dance, they get to move, they get to know their body and how it feels and how it moves on stage way better than the other ones used to do. So it's getting better and better.
Well, one of my early friends in life mentioned to me, and he was a violinist, he said, the most beautiful musical instrument, Charles, is the human voice. And so I guess those who like that kind of music and those that kind of drama should definitely make a point of going to see Tosca. Tell our listeners, for those who don't have a lot of money, because I remember doing an interview once with one of the publicists for VOA, that they did a special production, I think, in the downtown East Side on one occasion. They did some various things. Is there some way students, youth, people without a lot of money can get a ticket without going bankrupt and not eating for a month?
They can call the Vancouver Opera, and Vancouver Opera will inform them of all the possibilities, because there are many possibilities, because the Vancouver Opera has a lot of programs, and they also have a SkyTrain and opera program, meaning that they give a SkyTrain ticket to get to the opera house very easily, and then the ticket is cheaper also to go to see that particular opera, but that's on specific nights.
Okay.
I don't have all the information with me right now.
No, but if people phone the VOA and they say, listen, I don't have a lot of money, I would really love to see this production. Phone the VOA and explain circumstances, and there may be an avenue for you to do it.
Yeah, and I'm surprised, because here there's a lot of that, way more than in Quebec, way more than I know of in Montreal. There's a lot of programs, a lot of education, also an educative awareness, how to get people to come and see opera. Because in the end, it's an investment. It's an investment for your imagination, for your emotions, for your culture, for entertaining. It's great. It's a great night, and it's a precious night that you will cherish forever.
All right. Well, Fanny Gilbert-Collet, is it?
Exactly.
Correct? Thank you very much for talking to Discussion tonight.
My pleasure. Thank
All
you.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, so that's our contribution to making you aware of Tosca by Puccini, starting this Saturday, October 26th. Now, on to normal discourse, but before we go on to normal discourse for discussion, and you are listening to Discussion at CFRO 100.5 FM on your radio dial, Vancouver Co-op Radio, I need to speak to you again about calling, because I don't think anybody's called us yet, and this is disappointing. We just had our one call from Sebastian earlier, and he gave a $20 a month sustaining thing. So now everybody's going to say, oh, well, Charles, you got already sustaining funds, so why are you bugging us to join? Well, I'm bugging you to join because that's our duty. 604-684-8494 is the number to call. 604-684-8494. Now, I can sort of picture some of my friends sort of hesitating. We don't know. Go over to the phone. 604-684-8494. And you say, you know what? I'm really not sure where my membership is at, but if it's not up to date, I would like to put $60 to another year's membership, or $10 a month to sustain Co-op Radio, or $20 a month. If you've got a lot of money, you can make it more than that. We don't mind. So Co-op Radio has been pretty good, you know, for a lot of us who like to break the monopoly of the media that gives very, very disinformation, I have to say, a lot of disinformation on the mass media these days, a lot of very limiting of what is allowed to be discussed. And editorially, generally speaking, it's, you know, in defense of the status quo, generally speaking. And so Co-op Radio affords a little bit of space for voices like ours here on Discussion that criticize quite strongly the status quo and encourage people to become political encourage people with information, to provide, you know, by providing some information, by providing a space for their voices, just as we did with that young assistant director. She's a 28-year-old young woman, Fanny, from Quebec, who is beginning her career in the arts. So, you know, but in a little while, we're going to provide space for another voice. And actually, right at the moment, our plan was to provide space for Chief Aaron James Salk, who is the chief of the Elsipogtok First Nation, which is a part of the Mi'kmaq Nation, the larger Mi'kmaq Nation. And this small village of about, I think it's about 3,000 people in it, or less even, in Big Cove, New Brunswick, in Kent County, New Brunswick, has been waging a very consistent struggle along, and this is very important to note, along with many allies in the Acadian Nation, les Acadiens, in the region near Moncton there, and also the other people of different national backgrounds who likewise are deeply opposed and concerned about the drilling for the drilling process called fracking, in which you drill very deep into the shale underneath the earth and you put under pressure a great deal of fresh water that has been polluted with a wide variety of chemicals, not all of which have been disclosed. So we don't fully know what those chemicals are. Now, what happened is on October the 17th, the RCMP carried out an extremely violent assault against a peaceful demonstration. And the epitomizing it is this wall of RCMP marching directly on top of this young woman who's kneeling on the road with a feather in her hand. And there's a nice picture, and it says, "You can't get this many RCMP officers to protect or locate missing Indigenous women in Canada, but you can get this many RCMPs to stand against this woman in the name of oil and gas." Very nice graphic. And it illustrates really the subversion of the Canadian state in many ways, many respects, turning it into, under the Harper regime, turning it into a rogue state whereby the instruments of law and order are increasingly turned over to the corporations, especially in the raw material extraction. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play... Everybody knows this demonstration was attacked on October 17th by the RCMP, and there were some police cars burned, and that's all to be discussed at some point, too, because there's this whole issue of agents provocateurs. I don't know all the story. Can't say whether they were or they were just defending themselves. I don't know that part of the story. But the fact is that they had an army of RCMP set the whole violence in motion on October the 17th. And in response, there were demonstrations across Canada, and there was a very large demonstration in Vancouver, BC, and it was attended by about 1,000 people, and I was there, and I got my little video out, and I videoed Grand Chief Stuart Phillip. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip is president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. We talk to him a lot on this program. We have a high respect for his capacity to lead. And I'm going to play you what he said to that demonstration on October the 17th. Not October 17th, just last Friday, whatever date that was, 18th. It was October 18th. It was the day after the 17th. Yes, the 18th follows the 17th. And 604-684-8494 is the number that you need to phone. And you need to talk to Joseph. So come on, you guys, get on the phone, give us a call, buy a membership, or even say how much you love our program. And yeah, do something nice like that. 604-684-8494. I know everybody's very, very busy, but somebody should give us a call and help out here with Co-op Radio. So I'm going to put this on air now. This is Grand Chief Stuart Phillip standing on the stairs of the art gallery with lots of Native people in their regalia, lots of non-Native people in the audience as well, banners and so on and so forth, and And so here he is speaking to the assembled multitude. So let's hear what Grand Chief Stuart Phillip has to say. If it'll play. Here we go. Oh, dear. Why isn't it making noise? This is not good. It's playing, but it's not going on the television. So, I mean, on the computer. This is not good at all. Wonder what is happening. Maybe I have to pull this out or something. Okay, well, Charles has made a mistake with the technical side here. I don't know why it is not producing on our show. So maybe I can ask our man to come in and he can have a look at it. Let me just say something in the meantime. Oh, dear. Oh, no. Brilliant. Okay, let's try this again. And this time we'll put the... Winter, put the sound on. Here we go.
An idle memorial swept around the globe. Those people, those very special people, the young, the old, the women that helped put Indigenous issues back at the top of the agenda. I have been involved for 40 years plus, and I have never, ever in my time seen the attention that our issues receive as a result of the incredible work of Idle No More last winter. There is a young lady that is here, and perhaps we'll hear from her, but she was in our boardroom when we did the event over here at Waterfront Station, and they asked if they could use the Union of BC Indian Chiefs boardroom to change into their regalia. And we had that incredible event over at Waterfront Station. We went back after it was over, and she sat there across the table from me, and she said, "You know what I think?" She said, "I really think this is about building relationships for what's to come." And I thought that was such a profound statement that the intuitive sense of our youth, of our young people, knew that we were moving towards this inevitable collision with the Harper government. So I want to say, welcome. Welcome to the Harper government's war against Mother Earth. Welcome to the Harper government's war against Indigenous peoples. Welcome to the Harper government's war against democracy and everything that this country for many, many generations and many decades has valued and treasured in terms of the ideals of democracy, of respect, and of human rights and peace. In a few short years, the Harper government has deconstructed, destroyed, and demolished that legacy and is attempting to create a republic and sell out the natural resource wealth to offshore interests in Asia, to the Americans, and now to Europe. Make no mistake, we are heading for a watershed moment in this country when all of those values that were responsible for creating this country, for the values that thousands upon thousands of men and women laid down their lives on the battlefields of Europe and other battle theaters around this world to defend the ideals of democracy, is being simply swept aside. And the Harper government is selling out the interests of all of our children and our grandchildren's grandchildren. And at the end of the day, it will be Mother Earth that suffers. We as grandparents, we as parents, aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, leaders, neighbors, friends and allies, have a sacred duty to defend everything that needs to be defended. We need to defend Mother Earth. We need to ensure the legacy we pass on to our grandchildren is that legacy that so many Canadians fought for over many, many decades and many years. What we witnessed yesterday, the brutality of the RCMP, the heavy-handed paramilitary response to a peaceful protest, was a message. And it was a message that was sent to British Columbia. It was a message that was sent and meant for all of us assembled here, that when the Harper government vetoed any notion on the Joint Review Panel to approve the pipeline projects, to approve the natural gas development, to approve liquefied natural gas exports to Asia and other countries, the Harper government is telling us this is what we may expect, that type of brutal response from the RCMP. So we have a duty. We have a duty to take this back into the streets like we did last winter. We have to be consistent. We have to do this over and over and over again. We have to give up our weapons. We have to know and understand that this battle is for everything, it's for all the marbles. This battle was a long time coming. And finally, we have a national government that's attempting to do what previous governments were unsuccessful in doing, and that's selling out the interests of all Canadians. So it's our duty to stand up in the face of that, again, as allies and brothers and sisters in the struggle, in the fight. And I'm encouraged to know that there are rallies, solidarity rallies, going on right across Turtle Island. There are rallies going on right across British Columbia, from Port Alberni to Penticton. In Penticton, they're marching from the MP's office, Dan Elvis, who is a puppet of the Harper government, a parrot, and they're marching from there down to the local RCMP detachment. I encourage all of you to organize locally, start at the MP's office and go to the RCMP detachment. I can tell you that there are new procedures that are being employed that come from the highest level, that come from Harper, and the ritual of injunctions and enforcement orders are gone by the way of the dodo bird. And we have been told that by the highest levels of the RCMP. Now what the charge is criminal mischief. The RCMP local commanders are told that they have absolutely no discretion when it comes to the peaceful protest, that they will simply walk up to the protesters, they will serve them with that charge, and they're obligated to move immediately. And before, it was the injunction followed by the enforcement order. It took over several period of days for that to happen, and there was time for and space for discussion and dialogue. That's gone.
Violation of human rights.
So I just want to end by saying that this is incredibly timely. The Dr. James Anaya was here just a few days ago. He met with a number of people in the crowd here, and he heard about the deplorable, the disgusting, the disgraceful abuses of human rights that are an everyday occurrence and have been normalized in this country. And he described the country as being in a state of crisis. We know it's the $650 billion worth of large-scale resource development projects that the Harper government is attempting to ram through. Prime Minister Harper wants to turn this into a petro-powered, and it's our duty to stand up and say no. Thank you. going to do this 7 times. I say stop, you say Harper. Stop. 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 Stop.
All right, there was Grand Chief Stuart Phillip giving his 7 generations call to stop Harper. And that was on Friday, October the 18th, just passed last week. There is a very good report. He mentioned the rapporteur who was in Canada, he's coming from the United Nations Human Rights Council. And there's a very good synopsis of his report, his tentative report at least, in the October 21st, 2013, number 118 TML Daily, which you can get by going to cpcml.ca. You have to go into TML Daily and look up number 118. But there's a very full report, plus lots of photographs of not only the resistance in a Big Cove, New Brunswick, pictures of these RCMP, pictures of these guys in camouflage uniforms with machine guns and stuff under their arms. I mean, it's really too much. Anyhow, and then there's this report of the rapporteur. Now, we've got about 20 minutes, and we're going to talk to our next guest in just one moment. And that guest is Jessica Ernst, who is waging a very important battle on the same front of opposing fracking. Now, this is so important to British Columbia. We need to give Jessica some time, and we will. And if we have to come back to her 2 or 3 times in the future, I hope she'll be patient with us. But we need to be articulate in our arguments about fracking. We need to be knowledgeable. And as everyone knows, in British Columbia, the Prime Minister, the Premier of the province, Christy Clark, has bet everything. All her eggs are in one basket, the liquefied natural gas basket. And she is open the whole field in northeastern British Columbia to fracking. And the Montney field. And she's subsidized Encana something like $112 million in tax break just recently to assist. And they're, of course, putting hydro lines. And they're going to make a $9 billion project at Site C, multi-billion dollar project in Site C, to provide these gas people with electricity, cheap electricity. So we have a lot to know, a lot to gain by having good knowledge about this. But before I go to Jessica, I have to give one last appeal to our listeners to call 604-684-8494. That's the number to call to join Co-op Radio. Co-op Radio requires memberships from listeners to keep the radio station going. It's been going since 1975, and it's always kept going because people have contributed money to it. Now, I know people are more and more pressed for money, but even a little bit helps. So whatever you can contribute to the radio station, much appreciated. 604-684-8494. So I'll try that one more time, 604-684-8494. And you'll talk to Joseph, and he will he'll take your number. He'll take your thing. Oh, some people have phoned. This is good. So I just had a little note. We had a $120 membership and a $20 donation and one $20 monthly sustainer. Well, thank you, everybody. I didn't know. I didn't see any little lights flashing on or whatever, and so I'm in the dark here about this. All right, now look, we got to get over to Jessica. Jessica is Jessica Ernst is a scientist. She is an oil industry consultant. But unlike many consultants and some scientists, this woman has a very high level of social consciousness and a sense of social responsibility, so that she feels she has to do due diligence in reporting on the facts of life as they affect the sector that she's directly involved in. So I'm going to go over to Jessica Ernst. She is waging a very, very important legal case. Jessica, thanks a million for taking time to join us. Just a minute, let me get you on the air here. Okay, there we go. Jessica, you there?
Yes, I think I am. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. Everyone can hear you.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you, Charles, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, that's nice for you to say that. Now, Jessica, it's an honor for us to have you because you are waging this very important legal battle. Tell our listeners right off the bat what this legal lawsuit is that you've launched.
Well, in about 2004, Encana, the company that Charles just announced, your premier has subsidized these big millions of dollars to, they fractured directly into my community's drinking water supply in secret. They lied about it before. They lied about it after. They're still lying about it. And it took me a long time to figure out what happened. Water wells started to go bad throughout the community, including mine. My water is not just flammable with toxic and dangerous chemicals, explosive levels of methane. There's also ethane. We don't know the chemicals in Canada injected. And I believe that every person has an enormous amount of power. And I realized as soon as I found the data where it was sent to me by an industry geologist and it was explained to me, when I saw the evidence proving what Encana had done, I realized I had to speak out, I had to stand up, I had to do a legal battle, because there's many ways all of us can do many different things, and our imagination is infinite in the things that we can come up with to do. Because I work in the industry and have the experience and am a scientist, I decided to take the legal route because I think money is one of the only things the corrupt politicians and our corrupt regulators and the companies that are violating our groundwater, health, land, and air and communities, it's the only thing they understand.
Wow. they do understand that. They sort of understand things like, you know, the storming of the Bastille as well, but we're not anywhere in that, you know, in that realm of social intolerance or social outrage at the Versailles of the modern day. So, you know, the legal route is a route to go in. Political protest is another route to go in. Getting rid of the Harper government is another route to go in. Getting rid of your government in Alberta and our government in BC, these are all routes that are part and parcel of this whole effort to, what can we say, block these big oil and gas monopolies from simply rolling over us. So what does your lawsuit specifically say and demand?
Well, the lawsuit, I'm not just suing Encana. When I presented evidence of noncompliance to the energy regulators, we have two in Alberta. We have the energy regulator, the Alberta Energy Regulator, used to be called the Resources Conservation Board, and we have Alberta Environment, that used to be in charge of all the fresh water. The energy regulator then violated in writing, in a signed letter copied to the RCMP, they violated my constitutional rights. And I believe they did this to intimidate me into silence because I think they knew I was going to speak out if I found out what Encana had done. The Alberta Water Regulator did everything possible to avoid responsibility. They enabled the cover-up. They allowed the children and the pregnant women here to bathe in toxic, dangerous water. They're still allowing this. They have told the people the water is fine. And so I'm suing the regulators as well as Encana. It's pretty near impossible to do. I remember in 2011 when we went public with the lawsuit, it took years to prepare because, of course, trying to get the public data has been almost impossible. I was invited to present at the United Nations, and I flew down to New York. It was still, to me, I can't believe it happened. And the night before I was to present, I was very nervous. I watched the election results in Canada. And to my horror, I saw Harper given a majority, which we're now sort of course, discovering. Lots of it seems to have been illegal. And I felt so sick to my stomach because I knew right away, with Harper as prime minister, my lawsuit pretty well is dead. I will keep proceeding with it, even though it's impossible with Harper as prime minister. I'm going to keep going. I think it's really important to keep going. But I really felt, and all these years I have thought, my goodness, this is so terrible, because this prime minister will never allow justice to happen. He will never allow my lawsuit to proceed properly. He has shown Canadians he has nothing but disdain for our rights, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and our court system. And what is fantastic right now that happened in New Brunswick with Canada, with communities across Canada, in Vancouver, in Victoria, across the world, standing in support with the Mi'kmaq warrior youth, and the terrible things that the RCMP did there. They've done terrible things to me too, but what they did there is so horrific and completely extreme and unreasonable. But what's happened is it has tipped everything over. And I believe the Idle No More, the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society, the youth across the world, especially in Canada, they're not going to let Harper win the next time. And he may even be gone before the next election. So to all of you, to all of the youth in Vancouver and all your other listeners and everyone in the country, my lawsuit now has come back to life.
Well, yes, and you heard part of Grand Chief Stuart Phillips' speech. He made a couple of things very clear, and I think he has a great deal of astuteness and wisdom in his words. He said, number one, we are at a great turning point. This is a watershed moment in Canadian history. And while other prime ministers have tried to sell out the country that weren't successful, this prime minister really has it to change Canada forever. That was his motive. He said that openly and publicly. And the Canada he wants to change it into is a Canada that is totally dictated to by the monopolies, by the Encanas and the ExxonMobils and the Statoils and especially in the energy section, and as well, you know, the other resource extractors, the mining monopolies and so on. He's lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in Canada in the manufacturing sector since he's been in 2006. And, Canada is being turned around. And as you point out, the violation of the Charter of Rights, violation of parliamentary procedure, the scandals. I mean, this Senate scandal just stinks to high heaven. But you can see the dictatorial nature of his regime. I mean, he dictates. He's the boss. And so on. He's attacked the scientists. He's attacked the Aboriginals. He's attacked the manufacturers. He's attacked the unionized work and so on and so on. So, however, this particular issue about the water is really crucial, and I want you to tell our listeners how you knew the water was funny and bad.
I'm a scientist, and I have 30 years' experience in this oil and gas industry, and I did not know what was going on because I believed the lies. I believed the lies that the Alberta politicians were telling us, and the regulators, as well as Encana and other companies. So things like, how did I know the water was funny? Well, my taps began whistling like a train coming really loud because there was, of course, I didn't know at the time. It took me a few years to figure it all out, connect all the dots. I had so much gas in my water well that it turned my water well into a better gas well than a water well. My dogs and I were living in an explosive risk for a few years. We were bathing in toxic water, but I didn't know. And the whistling was the gas forcing my taps open to let the gas out. So you can imagine in the wintertime, living with methane and ethane blowing into your home. My soaps and shampoos, all of a sudden, I had very wonderful soft water, and suddenly the same soaps, I had not changed any soaps, they suddenly didn't make soaps or suds at the dishes, doing dishes at the kitchen sink, or washing hands, laundry, washing hair. Then I started noticing incredibly painful caustic burns. Oh, there were so many things that were happening, and I kind of thought, you know, something's going on here. But my family, the women in my family said, you know, we have a lot of problems with menopause. I'm middle-aged, so I thought, this is menopause. I guess the women were right. This is really awful. Skin burns, and
so
it was very painful. And then
what was the final straw that said, I know something's wrong?
Yeah, just before the final straw, the plumbing stuff, the whistling taps and everything, I thought was plumbing. So it wasn't until one day I poured water for my dogs, and they backed away from it in revulsion. One of them, the bigger brother, was actually snarling at the water, and then I knew. And being a scientist, it just hit me. I went, they have been lying. They've been fracking. And around here, they were lying and saying they would never do coal bed methane here, but I thought they have been doing coal bed methane. And a warning to the people of British Columbia, I've had industry people tell me they'll never do coal bed methane on Vancouver Island or in some parts of the south of British Columbia. But they told us that here. And the government is giving $50,000 incentives for each coal bed methane well that any company will drill, including on Vancouver Island.
Wow,
and
that's pretty bad.
Lots of people don't know that.
No, I didn't know that. And that's from Clark? Or?
Well, I don't know when. I do not know when this incentive was put into place. There's an energybc.ca website. I can send you the link, Charles, later. You can share it with your listeners. But I noticed it a few months ago, and there was a recent update, I think January 2012, and the $50,000 per CBM well, per coal bed methane well, is still there. That's atrocious. None of these companies should be subsidized. If fracking is such a fabulous miracle and the companies are going to make so much money and give us so many jobs, they should not get one penny.
No, they should
in
pay.
Subsidies.
They should pay for taking the natural wealth out of the ground, and
that
belongs
right
to the people. Now, there's a couple of things. One is just to remind our listeners that Encana, which is the company that Jessica is suing, is the largest single donor to the Liberal Party of British Columbia and main financier of that very slick advertising that was carried out in May, before May, by the Liberal Party in British Columbia. And they were very clever at it. One has to give the devil their due. They ran a sophisticated set of bullshit ads. But you know, that's how it works. You run bullshit ads, and you create an atmosphere. So there was no discussion about the issues. There was no attention paid to the significance of fracking or what we know about fracking, as just one example. And it should have been a major example because, of course, she herself made liquid natural gas being exported out of Kitimat and other places the big issues. And of course, these are not big manufacturing plants. They don't hire that many workers. Her numbers about the number of workers she claims are going to be hired is ridiculous. So now, Jessica, I want you to tell me a little bit about the coziness. Just spend a minute or two with me about how the Redford government, and we remind ourselves too that when you're in a box like Encana or ExxonMobil or Statoil or Chevron or whomever who is digging the dirty oil out, the bitumen, or going for natural gas, you're looking to get that out to the Asian markets, very desperate to do so. And so to do that, you need three governments in your pocket at least. You need the federal government, you need Ottawa, you need Edmonton and the government of Alberta, and you need Victoria and the government of British Columbia. So just remember that they did a hat trick, these oil monopolies. They did a hat trick in 2 years. They did Harper with 26% of the vote or something, got him a majority government in May 2011. Then 2012, it was going to be, the Wild Rose Party's going to win. Wow, we're all wrong. Too bad. It's Miss Redford, the, you know, favorite of the oil companies. And then exactly a year later, May 2013, same thing. NDP's a shoo-in, da-da-da-da. And then, oh my gosh, we were all wrong. And look, the Liberals are in there. And to think that these oil corporations can't manipulate these things and get their way, we have to. So big issues facing all of us. Now, Jessica, sorry, come back to you and ask you to again, just how do the coziness between, talk to us about Alberta's government's relationship with these oil monopolies like Encana, like the big oil companies in the tar sands.
Well, before I go to my province, Christy Clark, one of the things I think your listeners need to know, her advisor for a while was Gwyn Morgan, who was in Canna's head CEO. He was also CEO or on the board of directors of SNC-Lavalin, that's undergoing a whole bunch of corruption investigations. He was on the board of HSBC, which has also been fined with corruption problems and all kinds of terrible things. This was your premier's advisor. Prime Minister Harper, when he first came in and promised Canadians, was his first minority, he promised us accountability, and then he wanted to appoint, he did appoint, the same Gwyn Morgan and Canna's CEO, the past CEO, to run that Accountability Act, to be in charge of the public appointments for such things as the National Energy Board. Fortunately, at the time, the opposition voted him down, and then Harper pouted, got all upset, and said, well, there'll be no accountability because I can't have my guy. That's how cozy it all is. In Alberta, it's much, much worse.
All right, now listen, unfortunately, Jessica, the time has run out, but I promise the listeners, and I hope you can help us, come on again with us. We're going to come back to this issue. There's big demonstrations coming up in Calgary, I think, against the Conservative Party convention. Next week, we're going to talk about that, and then we'll come back to this whole fracking business again. How's that?
Excellent. Anytime, Charles, you call. And I do want to commend Vancouver and your community for the great things that you've been doing.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. You've had it. 604-684-8494. That's the number to call to get your money into Co-op Radio. Stay tuned now for Union Made.
Sisters and brothers, the programs Union Made featured every Wednesday on Vancouver Co-op Radio.